So we move to our next session on the IFRS 17 disclosures on transitioning to a new standard. IFRS 17, as all of us may know, became effective on the 1st of January this year, and we'll expect to see the first reporting under IFRS 17 in the middle of 2023, with full annual financial statements being prepared for the 2023 calendar year end. Over the last few months of 22 and with the annual reporting season at the beginning of 23, large global insurers have provided a relatively detailed view on the impact of IFRS 17 and their IFRS equity and future IFRS earnings. These disclosures give insights into the information required by key stakeholders and users of financial statements for insurers, Members of the LAC IFRS 17 subcommittee will present some of the key information given in these disclosures from the global listed insurers, and then hold a panel discussion on what we can expect to be different in the impact of IFRS 17 for the South African and broader African insurance market when compared to the global outcomes. They will also discuss how the insurers can prepare their stakeholders for the new reporting regime. So Andrew is no stranger to the platform today, but I will share a little bit of his bio from an IFRS 17 perspective. So Andrew is an actuary with 30 years' experience in the insurance industry. He currently chairs the ASA LAC IFRS 17 subcommittee. He is a director at Deloitte Africa and leads the financial services and advisory business, a unit focused on providing advisory and assurance services to banks and other financial services companies on quantitative risk management and regulatory changes. He has led the firm's IFRS 17 insurance contracts offering over the last 6 years and is a lead director on a number of projects assisting local and global insurers' IFRS 17 programs. Andrew is joined by his fellow panelists, and I'll let him introduce them to you. Okay. Over to you.
Can I keep your computer for questions?
So hi guys. For those of you who know my career, it started in employee benefits, it moved into product, it's now in financial reporting. I had dinner with someone in the employee benefits space last night to talk product this morning, talking 17 now, and I've got dinner with some accountants this evening. If I take Ron's model into account, I need to consider what my future might look like. So I might be the accountant on the panel in a few years' time if Ron's model comes to play. But I suppose what life insurance seminar would be we complete without an IFRS 17 discussion? And as Delicia said, what we're here to talk about is not the technical details of IFRS 17. I was on a panel 5-6 years ago. Some of the people on the panel this time were there with me as well. And we were unpacking all of the niceties of the CSM and the loss component and reinsurance loss recovery components and all those things. We're now past that, and I think what we are is at the end of a 20-year journey that we're starting to see numbers. And as Alicia says, we're waiting towards the end of this year to start seeing some real numbers. But we have been given an indication of what kinds of changes we are seeing. Preparers have put information out into the market around what the shifts from an equity perspective are and how they expect their performance to look under IFRS 17. So today, some members of the committee are with me to just talk about this. I've got Lloyd Balshaw on the line. He's an associate director in the Deloitte team, has been working on IFRS 17 projects for a number of years. He's actually currently on vacation in Europe, so you can call this a field trip looking at the international insurers, but he's so passionate about the topic that he was prepared to come off some of the snow and come and talk to us. So he'll give us a presentation on the global side. To my right, Jaak Nemand has been involved many more years than I have, starting from IFRS 4 into embedded value, MCEV, Solvency 2, leading up the Momentum Metropolitan IFRS 17 efforts. Next to him, Ivan Donian from Sanlam, also looking at their IFRS 17 program, moving into the transitioning into reporting under IFRS 17. Malusi Baloy, more than 12 years' experience in microinsurance, life insurance and reinsurance, making sure that the financial solutions that actuaries bring to the African continent are meaningful and make a big impact. And on the far right, Tracy Lister, looking at IFRS 17 developments, particularly for small insurers with QED, and advising across the continent as well. So we're trying to get this perspective from the listed company, well, from global listed companies, smaller companies, and onto the continent. So without further ado, over to Lloyd, who will give a presentation on what we're seeing, and then we'll open it and I'll ask the panel some questions and then open to the floor for those kind of questions as well. So over to you, Lloyd.
All right, thanks, Andrew. Andrew, just to check that you can hear me all right?
Got you perfectly, thanks.
All right, perfect. All right, hi, everyone. Sorry I can't be there in person, but this is arguably more fun than being on the slopes. All right, so I'm just going to give a quick update on IFRS 17 communications that have come out so far, looking at a bit of a global perspective for life insurers. Now, this is something that's evolving very rapidly. You know, even this morning, I think Manulife released results. A few days ago, HSBC released results for their comparative year. So every single day, this keeps evolving as insurers are enriching the information around IFRS 17. And I think it's a really exciting space, but one that certainly needs a close eye to watch what's going on almost week by week, but month by month will probably do. So what I've used today is my own research, research done by Deloitte, research done by KPMG, EY, and PwC. So I tried to bring it all together, making sure that the most comprehensive view can be brought through to everyone. So if we look at the reporting timeline and a lot of what's been reported between January and March 2023 has been investor presentations. So quite a bit of work gone into explaining the shareholder equity impact on transition. Some have given, a lot have given qualitative impacts on earnings. Some have even started giving quantitative impacts on earnings. And that's also, you know, what we've also seen is the ISX component of financial results, where design decisions have been clarified. It's been very scattered in terms of the amount of detail that each insurer has been putting out there. But some of the common themes I'm going to try and compare today and build a bit of a distribution so that we can see what some of the common themes are. Between March and June 23, there's quite a lot of insurers who are going to be producing transition reports. Some will include their full year 22 comparatives. So, for example, HSBC, they released a set of results which looked into largely your paragraph 100, 101 disclosures. That's your risk adjustment roll forward, CSM roll forward, your BEL roll forward, and that's been really insightful to say, okay, well, this is IFRS 4, this is IFRS 17, and try and build a bit of a narrative around what's happening between each basis. There's also Q1 reports that need to come out, so that's the reason for, we're also seeing HSBC, we're seeing BNP, and a lot of insurers, either in Canada or in Asia, producing these Q1 reports, and quite interesting to see the results that are coming out. But in a South African context, probably more relevant is the H1 interim report. Now, to get that right, you're obviously going to need to have a 31 December 22 balance sheet, so that you've got that as your base, as well as your half-year statement of comprehensive income and disclosures. And obviously, interim reporting is not the same as year-end reporting, so it will be up to the insurers to decide the amount of detail that they put out there. But again, we're expecting the paragraph 100, 101 type disclosures to come out. And then ultimately into March 24, we're expecting full year results. And I think 2022 is going to be the comparative year is going to be really, really interesting for comparison between IFRS 17 and IFRS 4. It's a very unique time, and it's only going to be once that we get to see IFRS 4 and 17 side by side. So I think it's really important to get that messaging right and not leave residual questions on the table heading into 2024. Now, obviously, this is for a 31 December year end, and it will depend on the company as to what they end up on their own kind of reporting periods for what their key dates are going to be. Looking at some of the bridges that insurers have shown, so this is Aviva, but quite commonly what we see is IFRS 4 to IFRS 17 equity bridge. So you release your IFRS 4 margins, they had IFRS 9 adjustments as well, but then they include their CSM, include the risk adjustments, and obviously you've got a tax impact for the move to IFRS 17, which gives them their shareholders equity. What they're also doing is adding back CSM to give an adjusted shareholders equity view, and that's actually what they're using for their leverage ratios now. So there's been adjustments to leverage ratios, given that they're now including their CSM, whereas before they wouldn't have included the IFRS 4 margins. Okay, so below that, we have IFRS 17 Solvency II walk. This is less common, but obviously quite relevant for Europe. differences in allowance for risk. So there's nuances around whether you can allow for risk across entities under Solvency II, and then other valuation differences that come through. But this bridge is less common, but still, I think, very valuable given the dividend paying capacity that Solvency II communicates. On the right, we have an opening balance sheet as up to the transition date for Allianz. And they went and showed their full balance sheet view, insurance contracts, reinsurance contracts, assets and liabilities. And then what they did is they zoomed into every line, into each of the insurance contracts, the liability and asset lines, and showed the component breakdowns of those line items, which I think was really useful to understand what transition looks like. Look at the split of approach. So in blue, I've got the fair value approach, red and moderate, and gray is full rate. You can see it's very varied. So Generali using around 5% fair value, KBC using around 80%. Interestingly, in the sample that I looked at, moderate was largely used for GMM contracts, not so much for VFA. And quite a few have drawn a line in the sand around 2016. As the date at which they will apply full rate, but really interesting to see this kind of scatter for insurers and impracticability and what it means for them. So here I'm showing shareholder equity and projected earnings. So on the y-axis we have the size of the CSM. On the x-axis we have the shareholder equity impact. So if you look, so in general, what we're seeing is a reduction in shareholder equity on move to IFRS 17. That's on average around 10%, but as you can see, it really does depend on the insurers. And what I wanted to do was explore, what percentage have an intuitive earnings to equity impact? So if you have reduced shareholder equity, you're obviously expecting higher earnings going forward. And if you have higher equity, low earnings. That's generally over the life of the contract, we know this to be true, unless you've got reclassifications or if you're communicating earnings over the next year rather than the life of the contracts, which a lot of insurers are. So a lot of insurers might have booked profits up front, and now they've got the CSM, which means they're going to have this drag on their earnings. And I think what I saw was the immediately obvious, negative equity impact, negative earnings impact, so the ones that really stand out, that was only around 20 to 30% of the time that we saw that, because, often it is more intuitive, but there really can be very valid reasons for why these might move in the same direction for the year post-transition and beyond. Looking at the CSM release profile, so again, very aggregate statistics. So what percentage of the CSM is being released each period? Around 6 to 12%, but that's the way insurers are communicating it. So some might spit out their annuities from their savings contracts on average, we're seeing around a 6 to 12% CSM release each year. The lowest I found was Munich Re with 4%, and the highest was CNP, French insurer around 12%. And we know the various battles that have gone on around annuities and how you release the CSM and coverage units, but we're not going to go into that today. Looking at the risk adjustment level, around half of insurers have disclosed their risk, their risk adjustment confidence level. Interestingly, Zurich was around the 90-95% mark. For their life business and 70-75 for short term, but this discrepancy is not always the case that you have life being much higher than short term. KBC had a 90% non-life confidence level and a 75% life confidence level. But on average, what we're seeing is around the 75-85% mark for life insurers is where companies are landing, but you do have outliers. So AXA, for example, is one of the insurers that contributed to this, where they're using a 65% confidence level for their risk adjustment, so quite a bit of a spread. Just calling out a few other accounting policies. Obviously, there's a whole bunch of accounting policies that are being made, but just some of the ones where there's a lot of, we've got a lot of information. So discount rates, on average, 85% is the percentage of insurers who are disclosing this. There's around 74% are using bottom-up. The remainder is split largely between top-down and hybrid, and where hybrid is used it tends to be GMM-type contracts or annuities. The risk adjustment, around 75% have indicated their techniques, and most using value at risk, some using cost of capital, and few using a provision for adverse deviation approach. And then looking at some of the reporting elections, so for OCI, quite a few have commented on it, but around 50 to 60% indicate that they'll be using OCI, and there's a very strong geographic correlation to this. So the European market is almost exclusively, or they're going to be, almost all insurers are going to be applying the OCI option. It's got to do with the IFRS 9 decisions as well. But in Americas, in the UK, we're generally seeing around less than 25% of insurers applying the OCI option. And then looking at comparative year expectations or results, some have begun building bottom line range expectations. Insurers like CNP, Aegon have gone and said, look, this is what we're expecting the earnings to be for 2022. And quite a few have shown, as I described earlier, a walk to IFRS 4. Performance information. So IFRS 17 is, it's going to be an ongoing discussion probably around embedded value and IFRS 17. I don't think we're going to go near it today or too near it. But this is from Allianz, and they had a Solvency II VNB, which they then bridged to an IFRS 17 VNB and new business margin. They made adjustments for the risk adjustment, for tax, for yield curves. But then what they did is they bridged from that point to the IFRS 17 CSM figure that they're going to be showing. So they adjusted for non-attributable expenses, contracts out of scope. And what that allowed them to do is to say, okay, well, this is Solvency II. This is their view of value of new business. This is IFRS 17. Quite close to an economic value of new business. And this is their reported CSM that's going to come through. And I think this is quite helpful to do this bridging and could be relevant in the South African context where we, for example, could bridge to own funds that could be distributable. Looking at some KPIs. So this is just looking at the CSM, but each metric's going to have a bunch of potential KPIs. So CSM margin being your CSM on new business or insurance revenue, or CSM over insurance revenue, your ability to sustain your CSM growth. So obviously you've got a release as well as new business coming on. So how is that looking? How does your new business compare to prior years? And then adjustments for the loss components need to be made as well. I'd like to go into more topics, but I do think we're short on time, but there's plenty to be said around onerous contracts, the separation of reinsurance now, which gives full sight of reinsurance profitability, albeit for adjustments for the loss recovery component. Tax, there's quite a good view of what tax is going to look like and the phasing period. And then there's a whole plethora of other design complexities around risk mitigation option, which is getting a lot of attention now given the changes in the macroeconomic environment. Other comprehensive income, the power wave, so that's the storing of fee variances between real world and risk neutral. That's going to emerge late on in the CSM release, and the non-distinct investment component. Now, something else to consider is because of this big shareholder equity impact that a lot of insurers are seeing, a lot of them are restating or updating their ROE targets around 200 to 300 basis points because they're saying, well, equity is lower, but we're expecting to have higher earnings, so our ROE needs to be adjusted, our expectations for this period of transitioning from IFRS 4 to IFRS 17 and probably a few years thereafter. There's a whole bunch of to be said around revenue and combined ratios where there's not discounting and separation of reinsurance, but I don't think we've got enough time to go into the detail of that today. But what I just want to close off with is this is just a view of 2022 and what everyone's been through. So quite high inflation, significant changes in yield curves, and a poor first half-year investment performance relative to H2 that then recovered. So this is 2022 FTSE. You can see the move to half-year was a real reduction and then a good increase to the end of the year. Similarly with the JSE, MSCI not so much, but there was a sharp fall in H1, which then kind of held to H2. And these are just yield curves from the Bank of England showing the significant changes in inflation expectations as well as the yield curves. So you can see in the black line for December 21 versus red in December December 22. And this does mean suddenly, you know, market, let's say the UK market, for example, where they said, you know, interest rates don't really affect us too much. Well, now there's going to be very big locked in to current rate discussions and impacts. And I think it's going to be very important to bring that narrative through. And the benefits of OCI are quite clear, but equally, if you can explain your results clearly and be able to isolate out second order demographic impacts between locked in and current, then you can navigate your way around the communications for these big shifts in yield curves. So that's a bit of an update on what insurers are saying globally. As I said, this is changing day by day, but yeah, Andrew, going to hand back to you.
Cool. No. Thanks very much, Lloyd, and thanks for those insightful views and deep analysis that you've pulled together. And, so we've seen what's happening globally. So I'll kick off the discussion with the panel to the representatives of two listed insurers who probably have more pressure in terms of immediacy of reporting. So Jack and Ivan, what do you see as the main differences that you expect between the global IFRS 17 impacts and what we might see locally because of local specific circumstances?
Just wanted to check that it's on. All right, thanks, yeah. So even when I did have a chance to confer a little bit, without sharing any information that's not publicly available, I should add. So I'll speak to three points, and then I'll go leave Ivan to speak a little bit about transition and transition assumptions. I think the first point to mention is a large part of the difference that we expect to see between South African listed insurers and the European and UK companies that have reported would be practices around historic profit recognition. So not differences in IFRS 17, but more differences in what companies have been reporting to date. And I think for maybe I would say slightly more casual observers or other users of the financial statements, it's quite important to note that if you look at what a company like HSBC or BNP puts into the market, those are banks. So they've credited VIF onto their balance sheet from day one. So their impact will be significantly different to a traditional insurer. So that's just an example. The second one would maybe be speaking to metrics. So I won't dig up Andrew and my history on EV, but I do think it's worth mentioning that some of the analysts are mentioning potential metrics where the CSM is added back onto NAV. Can I put it that way? And in a way, that's sort of getting us back into an EV view, which South African insurers have been used to, and we're likely continue to do in some shape, way, or form. So I do think that we'll probably see less exotic metrics coming out in the South African market, a bit more standardized metrics, but with a continued focus on our additional information as we have. And then maybe without going into the interest rate environment discussion too much, I do think that's a question on its own, which we could explore a little bit later. But I think it is worthwhile noting the choices that European insurers have made around OCI. And in a way, that does link with the historic thinking around marking to book value and their IFRS 9 valuation of assets, and to what extent they actually do manage investment assets on a mark-to-market basis. So I think they will have interesting challenges in explaining transition to OCI, but we will have interesting challenges in explaining market volatility. So I think those would be my three observations from what Lloyd has there. Just maybe one question, Lloyd. I'm not sure whether you can still hear me. I want to check something with you. When you said intuitive results, you're talking about a decrease in equity as well as a decrease in earnings. Is that? I just wanted to check that I understood you correctly.
Yeah, so I think the messaging there is, you know, an accounting standard doesn't change the profitability of contracts. So if you've got a reduction in equity on the move to transition, you're expecting an increase in earnings thereafter. Okay. Well, yeah, now obviously there's people tend to be thinking, okay, well, over the next year rather than over the life of the contract, so reclassifications, which might mean that's not true, but yeah.
Okay, yeah, no, so the exact opposite of what I said. No, 100%. No, that's fine. That's 100%. That's also more intuitive to me now that so happy that I'm understanding you correctly. I think our sample is a bit smaller, so I think it would be difficult to translate that range of the intuitive result into the South African context. I think we've maybe got a smaller sample of listeds.
Thanks, Jaak. Just to add a few points to what Lloyd said on transition approach. So obviously it also depends on the business mix in terms of the distribution between the different approaches. I mean, an insurer that writes a lot of short contract boundary business will hopefully mainly fall within fully retrospective because they only have to go back 1 year or less. If we just quickly comment on, I know Melusi is going to comment on Africa, the wider Africa insurance market, but maybe just quickly mentioning that clearly, I think the fair value approach for the longer term business insurance business will probably be more relevant, just given the general lack of historical policy and actual cash flow data, as well as the granularity of results needed to perform retrospective calculations. I think locally it'll probably also be a bit of a mixed bag in terms of the distribution of business across the three transition approaches. Maybe just quickly focusing on the fair value approach is probably the one approach where it might be a bit more challenging to compare the impact of methods and assumptions between insurers. Yes, there will be additional disclosure, hopefully, on critical estimates and judgments. But there are different methods that can be applied. First prize, I think, is still to use actual transaction data where that's available. So in the where there's a very liquid market, like for UK annuity business, they'll probably go that route in most cases. South Africa, some insurers have said they'll use an income approach, which is basically a discounted cash flow approach. And then there's other methods that seem to be considered in the UK and Europe around adjusting EEV or MCEV or even the IFRS 17 risk adjustment where the cost of capital or value at risk methods are applied. And then just the last point, the interest, I think the interest and the general economic environment could also have an impact on the fair value calculation. The required return for a hypothetical transaction between market participants is a key assumption, and it will partly drive the CSM in terms of what assumptions are being used for the equity market risk premiums, which will also differ between developed and developing markets.
Okay. Thanks, guys, and thanks for those insights. Just moving across to Melusi. So if we look at, you know, we've discussed it mainly on the big multinationals, the South African listeds. What do you think the impact's going to be on for the smaller insurers and particularly the ones across the continent in terms of their expectation and how they're going to communicate that into their stakeholders?
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. So what we tend to see most of the work that we do in East Africa is that most of the countries there tend to follow sort of very formula-driven type methodologies in the calculation of the liabilities. And typically this would just be taking whatever the statutory methodology is and that kind of gets used also for the reporting basis. So to the extent that you're looking at something like that, we expect that there will be large impacts when entities then move on to IFRS 17, particularly where the contracts are not short contract boundaries. So this is what we expect to see in most of the countries. Kenya is different in that they have a regime where, you know, the methodologies are quite complex, very similar to South Africa. So my expectation is that, you know, we should see similar to similar sort of issues to what we see in South Africa for Kenya. For most of the entities that I've seen, their contracts tend to be short, in which case it's mostly sort of your PAA. I believe there's still quite a lot in terms of disclosure to as they transition to IFRS 17, explaining the methodology and some of the reasoning, because when you use PAA, you still have to kind of justify why that is relevant. So my expectation is that there will be a bit more to talk about with regards to that. And that sort of leads me to also the point around even in South Africa with microinsurers. The expectation is PAA and really not a lot of complexity. The one thing that is scary is, you know, when there are some contracts that might be onerous, then you have this sort of loss component that you have to deal with, and I think that would be a nightmare if any of the entities find themselves in that. So it's always simple until that kind of scenario happens, so hopefully no issues. There's still some uncertainty, Andrew, around this aspect of, you know, when you think about the LIC, LRC, it's sort of similar to your UPR, IBNR. So for the most part, it should be okay. But, you know, there's still quite a bit of uncertainty on what actually constitutes, you know, when you say it's an unearned premium, you know, now in the IFRS 17 world, you're looking at this insurance revenue. So there could be some nuances there that will lead to a little bit more need to explain.
Cool. It's just easy if I use this mic. The guys have to swap mics. So Tracy, what Munisi's saying there is that particularly across the continent, the sort of general approach is to try and align with their local regulatory bases more than necessarily the sort of theoretical rules within IFRS 17. What's your perspective around whether or not the objective of achieving consistency of reporting is going to come through when you look at it with that lens?
Thanks, Andrew. So that's at QED, we also have a lot of exposure across Africa, and that pressure to keep doing what we have been doing and reluctance to change is very much there. I think my biggest concern, and I guess it's, I know the comment earlier from, I forgot which David it was, I think it was Kirk, I wrote it down, you find it. Yeah, where you said that you're on your slide, the misplaced hope of reliance on external orders to ensure consistency. I've actually got the other expectation from an IFRS 17 perspective, when it's the auditor's responsibility to, in some ways, help achieve that IFRS 17 desire, versus the desire of the countries and the companies not to change, and they don't want to move away from what they know and what they're more comfortable with, to move into this new environment of IFRS 17, which does try and bring consistent principles across. And I think, so my expectation right now is really putting it on the auditors to see if they will allow that and say, okay, you know what you've got, it is reasonable, versus what you've got is actually, it isn't right, you need to change. So I think I'm actually going to end up going back with, I potentially see that each country is still going to end up doing with what they're doing, because I don't know how many auditors within their own countries are going to force a change versus just letting it go through as long as they've sort of justified it, that it's, you know, it's loosely right, let's get it, let it go through. So I think, let's see what the auditors say.
No pressure. Give us sort of, let's call it 8 or 9 more minutes. What I do want is to be able to answer questions from the audience here or online. I'm just looking at the questions online. I can keep firing questions at the panel, but if there are questions, please put up your hands and we'll take questions from the audience or from online. Mr. O'Brien has not disappointed us.
I see a lot of work trying to explain why we've moved from 4 to 17, but that jump in Allianz was a big number. Is the market just saying, ugh, this is all just the same stuff in a different way? Or will they begin to start diverging their valuations from some companies that are swinging one way versus the other way, if that makes sense? So how is the market responding to IFRS 17 numbers?
I'll try, David, but I don't think I'm going to give you a good answer. I think there's so much more noise in the market on other matters that whatever's been put out, IFRS 17 wise, hasn't changed relative valuations from what I can see. But I think someone with a little bit more insight or who's tracking that information closer will give you a better answer. But I certainly don't see any impact from what's been communicated to that. I just think people didn't understand results under IFRS 4 and they probably having some difficulty understanding it on IFRS 17. So that's, that's my only explanation for the explanation.
So Jack, I think you're 100% right. I think the discussions we've had with global investor community is that this has probably been more an education session about how insurers make money than anything else, because the opacity in IFRS 4 was the problem. So yes, I think there is going to be a transition into that. I don't think they're going to be big revaluations at this stage, but I think there's a deeper understanding of what is coming out. And so that is why some of the guys are putting a lot of effort into explaining why their business model might be different to someone else's and why the results are different to someone else's. That is the big game theory happening at the moment, who's reporting what. Lloyd, I don't know if you want to add a closing thought on that. I do have a question online.
I agree, Andrew. I think the only other thing to add, you know, we had those discussions with the global investor market, and they were saying that it's actually quite simplistic the way the market might react to some of the information coming out. So equity going down, the market needs to appreciate why that's happening, and you know, to be able to say, okay, that's not a bad thing, because there might just be some. Traders who operate on little information who just say, well, that's a bad thing. So I think there is a whole lot of investor education that's happening. I'm speaking on the global market. Andrew, you've covered South Africa. But I think there is, as you say, there's a lot of education that needs to happen to be able to digest these numbers properly. And 2022 makes it quite complicated given all the other macroeconomic things that were happening in the year.
Okay, so Peter Croswell scratched the itch that had to be scratched, and this is the one that opens the door for myself and Yuck to have another fight. So is embedded value dead, or do we think that there is enough important information under IFRS 17 that EV will remain important? I'll give Yuck his chance.
So I think Andrew and I have sort of almost like reversed our views on this, haven't we? Have we not?
I'm still okay. Consistent.
Okay, all right. Okay, now so I think the last time I got asked this question was in 2019, and then I said EV is likely to continue, and I do think it will continue, but it doesn't detract from the point that Peter's trying to make, in that if people look carefully in IFRS 17, you're actually going to find what you need, assuming that there's a decent profits explanation added. Most of the analyst questions I get on the EV section of a report don't relate to VIF. They relate to IFRS earnings that need to get explained. So provided enough explanation on IFRS earnings, we may ultimately start moving away from EV, but maybe not in our lifetime. You know, if it took 20 years to get IFRS 17 in, it may not happen in our lifetime.
I put down in 2019 that EV is going to die. My contention now is that I was probably wrong by timing perspective. Having spoken to some analysts, the amount of time it took the investors to understand EV was incredibly long. And so taking that away from them is going to be problematic, and they will just put a bigger discount on the shares. So the way I'm seeing it is the analysts will look for EV for a couple more years until they understand the behavior of IFRS 17, but I still stand that the information available under 17 can replace the supplemental disclosures, and it is under a tighter and more auditable framework than the potentially divergent views of EV in MCEV and EV and all of those that come through. But I think it'll give us time. I don't think it's away from our lifetime. I think it's sort of 3-4 years, not 20. Yeah, I think I've answered the other anonymous attendee. So you know, let's call it there. We are 10 to 15 minutes sort of over time for tea, but I think thank you very much, panel, for participating. Thank you, Lloyd, for your research and your insights from the global perspective.
Thanks, everybody.